everybody, welcome to the first episode of Media Voices for 2019. I thought 2018 was going to be a very active year, but I see already we've had congresswomen criticised for dancing in college and people staging a protest outside of Greggs in the UK for having a vegan sausage roll. So it doesn't look like this year is going to be any calmer. Esther, how was your Christmas?
Calm.
And we're very lucky today to have with us Damian Radcliffe, who is the Carolyn S. Chambers Professor in Journalism at the University of Oregon. Damian, how was your Christmas?
It was great, thank you. I was in Japan, so where they don't have Greggs.
But they do have KFC.
Yet. They do, and KFC is basically what people eat on Christmas Day, and strawberry cheesecake.
Wait, yeah. What?
Yeah, did you not know this?
No.
Oh, it's one of the best stories about marketing that you can find. They basically said, well, KFC isn't selling as well as it should in Japan. Let's market it as almost the traditional American Christmas dinner.
That's what they do. They order in, and you saw these adverts everywhere. You go to sort of 7-Elevens and you'd have people wearing Christmas hats, you know, pictures in the window of someone wearing a Christmas hat, holding up a chicken wing, looking extremely happy.
So it's like the Coca-Cola of, like, Coca-Cola's massively influence over here. This is weird.
Seriously, you should look that up. It's amazing. Damian, but you've done more than just go to Japan. Why don't you tell everybody how you got to where you are today?
So, yes, I have done more than just visit Japan in my life. So I've been working in the kind of media communication space for more than 20 years, which I'm not that keen to admit, which included working with Chris at the dearly departed Media Briefing back in 2015. And I continue to write and teach and do research work around media business models, trust, changes in journalistic practice, innovation across the creative industries, and so forth. So that kind of ties in, I think, a lot with the themes that you explore in this podcast, and I learn a lot from this every week.
Oh, nice. Thank you very much. I didn't even ask you to say that. But yeah, this is going to be a sort of, how do you describe this, Esther? Almost a look forward to 2019, seeing what lessons we can pull from last year.
Yeah, I think that's exactly. So much happened last year. I can remember we were trying to keep up with it every single week on the podcast. It was always like, oh, this has been a really busy news week. So I think we were going to pick out some of the kind of highlights, some of the good things, some of the bad things, and actually what will that mean for 2019 and if, you know, people are sort of planning their strategies for 2019, what lessons can you take from that?
Yeah, absolutely. And lucky enough to have Damian here, who has, you know, experience outside of the UK. Obviously, he's based in the US. And Damian, you write about the Middle East quite a lot as well, don't you?
Yeah, I do. And that's a very, very different market. But it's also one that everybody's trying to get into because, platforms are doing kind of really interesting in stuff there. It has a massive youth population. They're very digitally savvy. A lot of the kind of big publishers as well as platforms are really interested in emerging markets, because I think one of the things that we're seeing, particularly with kind of Europe and North America, is that you're seeing a lot of saturation and efforts to kind of grow and kind of get scale in terms of new users and new revenue streams is arguably getting harder. So looking at exploration into Asia Pacific, Middle East, possibly even in India, I think, you know, that's something we're seeing a number of media organizations experimenting with and playing around with.
Yeah, definitely. Now, it's interesting you started there by talking about platforms and talking about platform almost saturation, because if you look at what happened with Facebook, particularly last year, we spoke about Facebook every single week. And honestly, I would love to end this year not talking about it quite so much. But Esther, was there a sense towards the end of the year that Facebook was almost had reached saturation point, that growth in the UK especially was going to be very hard to come by?
Yeah, and obviously, you know, it had scandal after scandal after scandal last year. And I know we sort of end up in a bit of a media bubble and we think, oh, wow, that's really shocking. But actually, this has started to permeate out to kind of what we'd term normal people. And, you know, one of the things I pulled out last year around, it was just towards the end of the summer, is that one in four Americans under 25 had deleted their Facebook apps. And you think about kind of the quantity of people that I've seen another wave of it in the new year, people saying, right, you know, my New Year's resolution is to quit Facebook. Certainly the last results I saw, the growth had plateaued in the US and the UK and sort of Northern Europe. It wouldn't surprise me if that started to drop off now, partly because of the saturation, but also partly because I think people are so much more aware of some of the things Facebook's been doing. You know, there's been all the political side of it as well. They're all migrated to Instagram, which is Facebook-owned and therefore not much better, but...
I think it's also easy to lose track of just how many scandals and how many issues there were. And as you said, it felt almost like every week there was something else, to the point where you have to almost remind yourself, well, that Cambridge Analytica, that was just 6 months ago.
That's
for
mad.
Example.
It's crazy.
The Soros story, the working with defenders, that was over the course of the last 4-6 weeks. You know, there's such a flurry of activity that it's very easy to lose perspective and lose sight of just how many things there were and in what a short condensed period of time. And I think that that has shaped you know, there's been so many of these things, it is shaping people's perception of the platform. People are certainly I think the narrative around tech companies was already shifting in 2017, and that's become much more acute in 2018. And I think one of the things we're not really talking about is people who do still have the app, who are still classified as monthly, daily, or weekly users. We're not talking about how much they're using the app. And I would argue, certainly what I see with my peers and with my students, is that those who haven't deleted it, who've kept it, are just using it a lot less. So they'll still show up on the subscriber numbers, on the user numbers, but actually the amount of minutes and time and attention that they are giving that platform is less than it was, and I think will only continue to diminish in the next year.
There is another trend as well, which I know a lot of publishers are seeing their end, is that people are moving, well, younger people particularly, they're moving away from having this kind of this wall where they showcase stuff, they post loads of stuff. They're actually moving a lot more to private messaging, small groups, things like WhatsApp's had huge growth. One of the appeals of Snapchat is that it's small messaging, and it's that I think is another trend that I don't think the older market kind of understands quite as much. But I do wonder if young people have got to the stage where they're almost so fed up of sharing their lives that actually they're taking that back in a little bit, and they've recognised that a closer group of friends is more valuable to them.
I think they're also just sharing differently. So one of the things that I'm just seeing is people are posting to stories what they would have previously posted to a wall or their feed. So it's a much more ephemeral sharing. It's a sharing of something that's available for 24 hours and then it disappears, rather than being something that is in the digital domain for a much longer period of time, potentially forever, by posting it to your wall.
So then what does that mean for publishers? Because publishers have been used to, you know, the wall, the newsfeed, as almost their distribution method for quite some time, or at least the ones who were focused on, you know, deliberate distribution on their social channels.
I think there's a bigger question here about publishers and their relationship with platforms this year. Part of it is actually publisher trust in platforms. It's not just Facebook it's mainly Facebook that have had, what was it, 7-8 weeks ago, we had the huge inflated metric scandal with videos.
That cannot have been 8 weeks ago. I was a baby when that happened, I'm sure.
but that's after Zuckerberg stood up this time last year and said, oh, by the way, yeah, we're turning the dial down on news because we want it to be all about meaningful engagements and that kind of thing. So if there are any publishers that honestly believe Facebook is still on their side at the start of 2019, I mean, their head's examined. And I think it's now that thing that a platform's a viable kind of, it's not that they're a viable place to publish to, but I think my argument here is that platforms should be a place to market your content, not a place to publish or to depend on.
Okay, so Damien, you mentioned Amazon before, and a lot of people who I've been talking to anecdotally have said, well, Amazon might be this kind of partner for publishers that Google and Facebook never quite were because interests didn't align. From your point of view, do you think that Amazon will be any better a partner than, you know, the duopoly has been?
No.
All right. Okay, moving on.
No, I mean, I think they've played a very smart game in terms of offering a lot of kind of backbone services, from kind of web hosting to the architecture, the ARC CMS that they offer through the Washington Post, syndicated content through the Post, and so forth, that have enabled them to become arguably increasingly indispensable for publishers. And it's almost a way of kind of clawing into that space. And then it's too early to tell what they're going to do with it at this point. But they have so many different assets, so many fingers in different pies. I think Esther is right that the reliance on, or the assumption that platforms are a way in which you are going to be able to make money or be able to monetize your product, I think has been proven wrong time and time again. And we've had many examples over the course of the past year and beyond, from Little Things to Mike to Slate, of being able to just see, you know, here's what happens if you go all in or are too reliant on platforms for your revenue. But I don't think publishers have necessarily learned that lesson. I mean, we've seen how many people we've seen go all in on Facebook Watch when audiences are really not consuming it that much. We're also seeing the likes of Spotify and Snapchat increasingly commissioning and paying for content. It feels a bit like what we saw when Facebook Live started and publishers were being paid to create content for it for a period of time to help the platform achieve critical mass, and then they withdrew that money and publishers stopped being as active because they weren't being given the financial incentive. So there is a really interesting tussle there between the potential value and exposure that platforms can give you. But the financial incentives, I think, are really interesting because when those are withdrawn, often publishers behave very, very differently.
So are we saying that one of the lessons that we should take away that should have been learned last year is that, you know, platforms are not the universal panacea to publishers' troubles, whether that is finding an audience or getting advertising revenue? Is the lesson we want in 2019 the same lesson that we wanted in 2018, which is that it is not a silver bullet?
I mean, I think there's... I know, sort of, you know, people like Kevin Anderson have written pieces about this. There is still a lot you can do with things like Facebook, things like Apple News. You know, they're putting a lot of investment into things like, what is it? It's not Texture.
Yeah.
Sorry, it's just Apple News. Things like Apple News. I think the thing is it's when that becomes a dependency. So what Mike cited, one of the reasons for its collapse, more or less completely, that Facebook had withdrawn, it was about $5 million of funding. Well, that's not a sustainable business model. So yeah, I think it's just that thing that, yeah, fine, you know, use it as a marketing tool, use it to get a bit of reach, but don't expect anything from it until it's sort of proven. I will make an exception. I think Twitter video is one to watch there, because Reuters has actually shown, right, you know, we put 20 videos out a day, this is the money we get back, we are making millions of dollars from this.
I'm not sure how many other publishers will be able to replicate that success, though. That is such a strength that is, you know, confined to Reuters alone. I don't know that many other publishers will be able to capitalize on that.
Well, and you also come back to this perennial issue of what constitutes a view, at what point do people get paid, and the inconsistency that you see across all of the different platforms. Netflix, I'm sure we'll talk more about them later, but it was revealed during the course of this past week that a view on Netflix is 70% of a piece of content, which is much, much higher than on any other platform. But of course, they're also not selling to advertisers. But you're not comparing like for like, but just very interesting that in a subscription-only environment, how you constitute success and views is very, very different to elsewhere.
So, I mean, talking about, you know, these great OTT services like Netflix, like Hulu, you mentioned that using them more as kind of marketing opportunities for traditional publishers. Could you just maybe expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, I think what's interesting when you look at the OTT space, and certainly when you look ahead as to what's going to happen in 2019, is just this gold rush of different organizations that are moving into that space. So the most obvious one that we're going to see during the course of the next year is Disney Plus, otherwise known as sort of Disney Flix. There was talk during 2018 of Disney starting to withdraw a lot of their assets and titles from Netflix and elsewhere because it's going to sit as part of their own OTT service. And they're going to have three different distinctive services. They are a major shareholder in Hulu. They have ESPN Plus, and then they're going to have Disney Plus. And then I think we're going to see other organizations. I mean, we saw CBS launched was it CBS Discovery last year, which was a new OTT platform for them. They've got the new Star Trek series that only airs on that channel. So we're seeing a lot of different organizations launching their own OTT services, potentially pulling back from the likes of Hulu, Netflix, Amazon Prime, and so forth to launch their own. But I think there are some really important strategic implications with that. The first is, people only have a finite amount of money to pay for stuff. 2018 was the year of the paywall. Bloomberg, Wired, The Atlantic, organizations that had typically eschewed paywalls, created them. Others like The New York Times, who've been all in on paywalls for some time, at the end of 2017 and into early 2018, cut back the number of free articles that you get. It's getting harder and harder to be able to access content for free, but people have no more money in their pockets. So I think what that means for consumers is they're going to make some really tough choices about the material that they consume, and that they're going to consume a narrower range of content. And for publishers and for media companies, it clearly means that scale is dead. It's really going to be about serving your core audience and then super serving that, and recognizing that actually, if I'm CBS and I can get 500,000 people who subscribe to my service because of this new Star Trek exclusive series I offer, that is a win. Whereas in the past, I would have wanted 10 times that amount. So it's a very, very different business
model. This feels like it's all going backwards.
What do you mean?
So, you know, you go sort of 6, 7, 8 years ago, you've got everything on TV, you've got your channels, it's all free, ad-supported. Then you get this thing that, you know, we all talk about the Netflix of news, the Spotify of news, these places where you can go, you can pay $9.99 a month and you can get everything. You don't have to subscribe to Warner Brothers films. I've used this example so many times for news, and it's all splitting out again. And it's really frustrating because, again, it just comes out as a thing that it forces consumers to choose. You're not going to be able to replicate Netflix's success, because Netflix has achieved that kind of scale. If you now split that out, it's not going to work.
But you can hamstring Netflix as a competitor. As Damien said, by removing some of that content, you are forcing consumers who might have gone to Netflix to go to your own. So it's not necessarily... I think that everyone has seen there is this propensity to pay for entertainment content, if not necessarily news. And everyone's suddenly gone, well, you know, if people will pay for a Spotify subscription and for a Netflix subscription and, you know, PS Plus, then why wouldn't they subscribe to mine as well?
We're going to see more and more pirating as that goes on. I think Game of Thrones was the most pirated show last year, just because not everybody wanted to buy a HBO subscription, which was $9.99 a month on top of Netflix. And that's just going to hemorrhage money in that respect.
But I think what's interesting when you look at music and you look at entertainment and TV like entertainment is the price entry point. And arguably it's pretty low considering the range of things that you get. And I think the challenge for news organizations is that I think their entry point is too high. If you can pay, I think I pay $7.99 a month for Netflix, for one screen version of Netflix. If you're paying $9.99 a month for an ad-free version of Spotify, that's not a lot of money. But if you wanted to get two or three new subscriptions, it tends to be considerably more. And so I think that is one of the challenges.
This is Apple News's argument. Apple News says, well, you know, if you want to come into this aggregation machine, those are the kind of returns you get back. You know, you will make more from 500,000 views on your site than you will from 6 million on our site, because that's the returns level here.
I think the difference there is that it's an Apple's it's not a like-for-like comparison, if you see what I mean.
You were about to say apples and oranges.
I was about to say apples and oranges, yeah. But I thought better of it, and now nobody said it, and it's not embarrassing at all. But it's the difference there is that, you know, news as a commercial proposition is so different from entertainment. You are not... People don't consume it the same way. There is not the same value. There's not the same ROI on producing a piece of news content that there is in producing any sort of entertainment. There was that great piece of analysis that came out over the holidays that Netflix will just pump out a ton of crap, low-quality Christmas movies because they know that people tend to watch it. Doing news well requires a lot of investment, and you don't necessarily see the same return on that you do from entertainment.
I think you can also argue that this price point is also one of the key reasons why you're seeing cable cutting. Continuing to increase. In the US, when I moved to the US from the UK in 2015, and I'm astonished at how much it costs to have a broadband package, a cell phone package, just kind of basic TV. It's considerably more than it is in the UK. And even to just get the most basic package costs a lot of money. And one of the key drivers for that in many cases was premium content like sports. And that would be a reason why people would keep a cable package, would be so they could get Monday Night Football and things like that. But a lot of that content is now moving to the platforms. We've seen Facebook, Twitch, Twitter, Amazon Prime, all looking, not just in the US, but all around the world, at purchasing those kind of rights. IPL, the 2020 cricket, has been on YouTube for some time. And if I can get that for free as part of an existing subscription that I already have, or just by virtue of already using a service like Twitter or Facebook, what's the incentive for me to throw down $100+ a month to get that on cable TV? So I think the crucial thing here in this whole discussion, it's the economy, stupid. How much money do people have? How much can they afford to put down? And how much do they value? I think that point is a really good point, Chris. How much do they value and put a monetary value to the kind of things that they're spending the money on? And for news, that's harder than perhaps it's ever been.
And I think you can see that reflected in, you know, people have been asking the question, is TV dead? Is TV in the US dead for years and years? And in the UK, we've seen a slight resurgence in ad spend on it. But in the US, all the indications do seem to be that for at least the larger channels, the larger organizations, ad revenue particularly has plateaued, which I think is why, Damien, as you mentioned, you're seeing all those people making acquisitions to grab all that content to hopefully make that value proposition for their own OTT services so much more attractive.
Well, and ironically, of course, those OTT services are probably going to be ad-free, or that you can kind of have models like Hulu, for example, has different pricing points, which enable you to see different amounts of ads, from none at all to only a few. And I think audiences in the US in particular are starting to get used to an ad-free TV experience, which historically has not been the case. I mean, you know, the amount of sheer ads you get on linear live TV is astonishing. And you can see it. There's a really good example. So we've started watching Jeopardy on Netflix, and the show is about 20 minutes long, and it's you can see where all the ad points are, because they say, and now we're going to go for an ad. The first ad is after 4 minutes of the show. 4 minutes.
It's bizarre.
And that includes the titles. And once audiences have got used to the fact that, oh, I can pay a little bit more and I don't have all of these constant interruptions, it's a much more enjoyable viewing experience. Why would you ever go back?
You know what I've really noticed that is true crime is Forensic Files on Netflix, where you go, holy shit, without ads, that is a soup to nuts murder told in 20 minutes. And again, you can see those breaks where they'd go, but who could have done it? And then it immediately comes back and you go, the husband did it. But obviously, with that kind of 3 minute ad break in the middle, it would have been much more effective.
And I'd apply the same principle to podcasts too, and podcasting. And I know, you know, the kind of audio resurgence is something that we're all really, really interested in. But for me, it's incredibly off-putting when a large part of the opening of a show is ads. Seth Rogen, I think the first like 6 or 7 minutes are ads. Pod Save America, it's the first 3 or 4. Now, obviously, I have the option to be able to scroll through that, which I can't do in a live environment. But I do think that audiences are increasingly wary of ads. There's a real kind of advertising saturation that people are just fed up of the volume of ads that they're exposed to, and are finding kind of ways to navigate around that, from ad blocking in the kind of digital online space to using other platforms where they can enjoy an ad-free experience, or where those kind of ads, where it just becomes more premium. I mean, I think that also is one of the opportunities in the podcasting space, is that historically you've had sort of three spots in which you could have ads: the beginning, the middle, and the end. And there is a value in that premium of being able to say, we only have these kind of three spaces, and that enables you to charge more than if you have 20 spots available, which is the, you know, the equivalent of a kind of live TV world.
Yeah, it's that scarcity.
And we hope all you listening to Media Voices are enjoying your ad-free experience. That's an education thing, though. I think what hasn't yet kind of really filtered through to advertisers is that you have an audience that listens solidly to something for half an hour. You know, if articles online had a dwell time of half an hour, you'd be absolutely laughing. And you've got a really committed audience that I think what we haven't seen is it doesn't match the scale of what people expect. You know, you very rarely get podcasts that have got sort of millions and millions of people listening to them. And that, I think, there's a bit of a disconnect. It's like 500 interested people are far, far, far more valuable than, you know, articles that get thousands and thousands of views. So there's a disconnect there, and it'll be interesting to see if that does kind of marry up a little bit more over the next year.
Yeah, I mean, that has always been the pitch for podcast advertising. It's to an engaged audience. That's why you see mattress companies spend so much to be there week after week after week. But yeah, it will be, like you said, it depends on whether podcasting and those companies like Megaphone and Panoply can actually communicate that effectively. Talking about...
It is still very niche, I think, podcasting, and it's very easy for us to get carried away with how exciting it is as a medium, which is rather ironic to be talking about this on a podcast. But But it's true, less than half the population consume it. But those that do, as Esther said, they're really avid consumers. If you are into podcasting as a medium, you're listening often to multiple podcasts a day, perhaps on your commute to and from work, but also around the house. The in-home listening for podcasting is really high, and that is often a surprising statistic. And so some of these innovations that you talked about, Chris, like dynamic ad insertion for podcasts, where that can be both personalized, if you're able to get advertising that is tailored to my interests, my needs, that is relevant to me, and that is well made and well produced and actually fulfills a need, then I think audiences still welcome that. It's just, you know, volume of things that are mismessaged or irrelevant to me, then that I can live without.
I think maybe
I think in some ways the amount of data you need on somebody to be able to deliver advertising that they need or is suitable to them is quite scary. Now, there's all these conspiracy theories at the moment about of people that have seen stuff pop up that's really obscure that they've talked about. So, you know, are your devices listening? I do kind of feel like in the general public space there is quite a bit of a reluctance against this kind of personalised advertising. Mm. It's like, well, what do you need to know about me in order to provide that?
There is a fantastic, I speak about it all the time, I'm sure I've spoken about it with you, Damien, a great Reply All podcast episode where they try and convince people that Facebook is not listening to them via their phones to serve them ads, and they cannot convince people because some of the coincidences are scary and the reality behind it, you know, these kind of shadow profiles that Facebook has and the geolocation data that they have and, you know, the knowledge of people who you're connected to's birthdays is actually in a lot of cases scarier than it would be if they were just listening to you anyway. So it's a...
And that's one of the things we mentioned about, you know, what are the opportunities for Amazon or for brands and publishers to work with Amazon? I think that is something that, you know, is incredibly valuable assets that Amazon has in terms of the sheer volume of data they have about your purchasing habits and indeed certain phases of your lifestyle, you know, stage of life that can be tapped into. So I'll give you an example of that. My second daughter was born in January last year, and at the start of every month I get an email from Amazon saying products for your 10-month-old, 11-month-old, and so forth. How do you know that that's how old my daughter is? Because I've not put that in any information obviously anywhere, but clearly they've seen purchases for things for a newborn in January of last year and been able to extrapolate from that, and we've seen that from with other retailers too. So that's a potentially interesting mashup of kind of retail data and being able to share that with publishers to create advertising propositions.
But I don't know if you guys saw this article. Sorry, I'm really untold. There was an article a while back. I think one of the things that that this kind of targeting needs to get better at is humanizing it, because there was a woman that said, oh, you know, Amazon and Facebook were able to track when I was pregnant. You know, they offered me all the baby clothes, all the baby stuff. Mm. But they then couldn't match up when she was Googling symptoms of miscarriage.
Yeah.
And then continued to assume that she'd gone on that journey. It's like, if you're clever enough to tell that I'm pregnant, you should be clever enough to work out that I've Googled all this stuff. I've obviously lost my baby. I've not been online for 2 weeks and you're still serving this stuff up and there's no way for me to opt out of it. And she said, if it's clever enough to do one thing, it should be clever enough to also figure out when it's not going so well.
I think for me, the big lesson with tech from 2018 and moving into 19, and I also think, you know, across the board, what we're really going to see in the course of the next year is continuity rather than kind of massive upheaval. Arguably, a lot of the most successful tech stories of the last year have been around kind of old traditional media that's just kind of reinvented through tech platforms. A lot of the excitement around kind of innovation around new ways of telling stories kind of seems to have disappeared. I mean, Esther, you made this point when we were talking previously, you know, what's happening with VR or AR or smartwatches, or, you know, we can write this huge list of tech innovations that were going to change the world, and actually they seem to have died a quiet death. And what we're really talking about is podcasting, which in many cases
it's the new radio.
And when we're talking about the new OTT services, essentially we're talking about traditional television in many cases, an ad-free subscription based experience, rather than just new ways of telling stories through video.
I do have to say, just to say a caveat to that, I did spend an hour in VR earlier today, and it was incredible. So fingers crossed it's still.
Well, I think when it's not published as doing VR. You know, I think it was the Guardian's inmate experience, the solitary confinement, and I think the FT did Hidden Cities as well. And since then, there's been nothing really exciting.
No, it's much more of a marketing opportunity at that point. It's much more for people who want to hawk a product or something than it is for publishers at the moment, definitely. Moving on, talking of things that aren't necessarily standing up, print. 2018 saw a...
That's a segue.
But, I mean, this is something we talk about week in, week out. Every week seems to bring a new bit of bad news about people who are either losing their jobs in a print environment or a magazine that's cutting back or scaling back or going digital only. And I think that Esther, you hit the nail on the head in the fourth paragraph of our notes here. As Peter would say, 2019 must be about less print but better print. Surely it is now about finding a much more bespoke way of actually getting print to factor into your revenue model that doesn't rely on vast distribution or kind of very anodyne generic content that could better exist online.
So basically scale is dead.
Well, is scale dead for print? I mean, I think that's the question that people need to ask. Look at what happened with Shortlist. We spoke.
But look what happened with Stylist. Stylist is being taken out to the US. And that's one of the things, actually, I'm really excited to see what they do with that in 2019.
Certainly for some genres, then, surely scale must be dead, or at least it's dead for most of the entrants into that market. Look at what happened with women's magazines this year.
Genericism is dead. If you know, a lot of the problem with women's mags is that you get the same content across all of them. And, you know, 10 lipsticks for autumn, you know, your fashion trends that actually... are basically chokers and what we were wearing 15 years ago.
Chokers are coming back?
But there are still some people doing some really, really cool stuff. And they say Stylist, you know, I have just mentioned it, a bit of a fangirl, but their content is superb. Their magazine is really sharp. Their magazine is intelligent and it's aimed at the urban woman. And that's their niche. They know exactly who they're targeting. And as a result, they are doing very, very well.
Well, and I think that's the key thing there is, it's about niche. That if you're, and I think this is applicable across the board, but particularly for print media, that you have to be offering content that is not available elsewhere, because otherwise there's no incentive for somebody to purchase your product. And so much printed material, and indeed so much digital material, is repetitive or just not worthy of people paying for it. And so there's also this really interesting kind of volume game that, you know, we've talked about the sort of the move away from scale in terms of audiences, but I'm not sure that a lot of publishers have kind of clocked that scale also refers to the volume of content that you produce. There's still a need to kind of pump out large amounts of content. You see, the Post does a lot of this. There was a really interesting story over the course of the past week about Forbes using AI so that when contributors who produce the vast majority of material for their digital output, not necessarily their print publication, but when you log on to their CMS, it will have a pre-populated article for you based on things you have written in the past, things that are trending, and it sucked in a whole load of different material and essentially given you a draft to tidy up. Now, I find that rather terrifying.
I was going to say, Esther, you look scared as well.
Terrifying prospect, but Forbes's model is still very much predicated on pumping out a lot of content and a lot of material, and I'm not sure
covering it all with ads so that you can't read it anyway.
Yeah, and I'm not sure that that's the right approach. I think that there is a value to niche, and I know you guys have talked about that before. But also, niche doesn't necessarily mean producing large amounts of copy. It just means providing stuff that's really good, really focused, really valuable. And you know, maybe some of these print publications, some of these magazines need to be half the size that they once were, but that every single piece is a zinger, and then people will be prepared to pay for it rather than looking at it and seeing actually so much of this is filler.
That's really interesting. And I think that, you know, if you look at some of the launches that we've had this year, and if you look at some of the people we met when we were up in MagFest, which is a celebration of that, it was these very small teams that were producing some absolutely fantastic you know, incredible print products that you want to buy there, you know, you want to display them on your coffee table. So it's not necessarily maybe the medium for, you know, for people who want to churn out that kind of very anodyne, very generic content. Maybe it is for those small teams and small organizations that want to reach their audience in a very, very targeted and very specific way.
I will say as a counteract to that, though, that there are still magazines, there are still women's magazines that are doing very, very well. You know, we spoke to Women's Health not that long ago, a couple of months back. They've seen consistent growth on the newsstand because they don't just say, right, we're aiming at women. They say we're aiming at women who are interested in health and wellness, and, you know, they've even branched things like mental health. And because of all of their stuff is fact-based, you know, all their articles have got citation sources from scientific journals, they're growing. It's also partly to do with the fact that wellness is such a massive thing now.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, everybody wants to improve their health and fitness, and it's not just about your body, it's about your mind and yourself as well. But there are still big mainstream magazines that are growing and doing well.
There are some really good successes there, you know, and it's still... I honestly don't know what the lesson is that's different from what we've been saying about everything else. It's knowing what your audience wants, and it's knowing that they want to consume something in that format, and that it's valuable to them. Look at what happened with Private Eye this year, increased its newsstand circulation. That thing has been going since, you know, the year dot, and it is still producing very, very high quality content. It's still succeeding as a result, but that's because it doesn't really exist anywhere else.
And it's also interesting to see that people are still investing in this space. People are still launching new products, still trying new things, which plays very much against the sort of print is dead narrative, that there are clearly plenty of organizations that still believe there is an opportunity here. And as we've talked about, those reasons can be justified if you have a whole bunch of kind of key elements in place. You can make this work. So we will in all likelihood see further new publications and offerings come out during the course of the next year.
But there are still opportunities arising for niche communities to cluster around a very premium print product. Dennis launched a magazine specifically around Fortnite, you know, the kind of multiplayer survival online game, which is, it's just crazy because the, you know, the perception is that people who play Fortnite are these kind of, it's a free-to-play game. Where is the value in that? And yet, if you look closely, Epic, the people who make it, are making a fortune because people are paying for cosmetic products. And therefore, Dennis presumably recognized the idea that there is, you know, there is a valuable audience there. It just happens to be clustered around kind of this tangential product that they can then monetize through a magazine as well. So I think Damien's exactly right. You're not going to see people stop investing in creating new products. It just requires an opportunity that isn't, you know, pumping out the same generic anodyne content that based on celebrities' Snapchats.
And recognizing some of these new niches like Fortnite, like esports, and others.
Should we do digital? I think we've touched on a lot of it at the moment. But
yeah, I think actually one of the things I found interesting about digital this year is that it's, like, print has always been rocky. Legacy subscriptions always had a fairly rocky time. And actually, 2018 almost switched that round. Mm. And actually, it's the digital ones that have been struggling. This has almost been the year that a lot of the digital pure play publishers have had a really tough time. And I'm actually struggling to think of anybody who's had a really good year and that there's a lot to learn from them. It all seems that they've all missed funding. They've all had to make cuts. There's the Unilad-Lad Bible merger. Goodness knows what's going to happen there. You know, personally, I don't think that's going to go very far, but it depends how long they stay on Facebook.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I saw a headline not too long ago that said, we're talking about, you know, new media in the same term that we used to talk about old media, and, you know, saying that they're, you know, that the rug has been pulled out from under them in terms of their revenue, which is definitely true in terms of advertising. Damien, you've mentioned Mike, Slate, Little Things, this whole raft of people who we thought were kind of these new, had found this model that was going to work online. And over 2018, it became very readily apparent that that's not the case.
Or they overextended themselves, like Vice, for example, would be, you know, they were one of the digital darlings. And I think the bubble has really kind of burst with them, both in terms of the expansion into TV with the Viceland partnership with HBO, but also that their kind of voice works well as a niche, but not necessarily when it, as mainstream, that then it starts to lose some of its edge, or that there isn't a sufficiently large enough audience that wants that kind of edginess and that kind of tone. The other one thing that's, of course, is really striking is the BuzzFeed membership program, which from what I can gather, doesn't offer me anything other than a tote bag for $100, which must be one hell of a good tote bag. And, you know, they're still a VC-backed private company. We don't really know what's happening with their revenues. The move to membership, to me, almost sends alarm bells ringing about, well, what's going on behind the scenes there?
Yeah, certainly.
Why do you need this extra revenue stream?
The whole wording and the way that all that appears, they've pitched it straight from The Guardian.
Yeah, it was very obvious that they just kind of gone, well, look, Guardian's membership scheme is doing okay. We need another source of incidental revenue for whatever reason. Let's get on it.
I don't get a Guardian tote bag if I support them. So
yeah, but you do get, here's the thing, you do get the sense that you're supporting Guardian journalism. And ultimately, I don't think that people recognize that BuzzFeed News is a separate entity that kind of does its own thing. I think that kind of the BuzzFeed membership is still muddied by the fact that what's people's perception of BuzzFeed is this kind of clickbait, low quality, like churning out cat gifs all the time. They're still contending with this, and they have been around for years. Well, you know, and that hasn't been the case for the last couple of years.
Which is why I think it'd be really interesting if they'd focus this on, say, Tasty. If they'd actually focus that on some of the niches that are less associated with BuzzFeed. But it's, I think, Damien, you were saying at the beginning that Tasty is massive and people are really excited about it, but it's not so overtly BuzzFeed that you think, oh, cat gifts.
Well, the New York Times is a good example there of a publication which has three different types of subscriptions. You can access kind of, well, there's the all-in, but there's also kind of news, there's cooking, and there's crosswords. Yeah. And they're offering kind of different product verticals around that. And there are people who will just take a New York Times cooking subscription. It'd be really interesting to see if other publishers can kind of commoditize specific verticals in that way. And I would agree with you, because, I mean, BuzzFeed News do great work. They have done some really, really good reporting. I mean, the most obvious heart-hitting thing over the course of the past year or so was some of the Russia stuff that they have done out of the UK publication. But you go to conferences time and time again, and people ask really quite condescending questions about news, which suggests that even people who are in the industry don't understand and realize that BuzzFeed does more than just cat gifts, lols, and listicles, and that actually you have really experienced, serious journalists doing really important, impactful journalism.
You can't produce both and expect people to assume the good stuff is good if you're presenting it alongside garbage.
So who else is doing membership that we think really well? I mean, we talk about The Correspondent a lot. Tortoise as well is somebody who, you know, has basically launched on the idea that they have a new digital product that people will pay to support through membership. So who else do we think is going to crack this year?
Actually, I think those two tie into something else that we saw this, well, now it's last year now, that we could see more of in 2019, which is crowdfunding. And actually kind of having big campaigns. You know, the Correspondent put it completely out there. They said, this is what we're doing, please come and support us. And they smashed their target. There was definitely a couple of weeks we were all a bit like, can they do it? Tortoise did a similar thing. It's much, much smaller scale, but they secured $500,000 of Kickstarter money to kind of do this slow media. So I do think this kind of this crowdfunding style, membership style, contribute what you can. There's been quite a few examples I've seen this year that it'd be nice to see going forward.
Is there the danger that we're going to see this, as we saw with subscription satiation, that we're going to see people's, you know, cash just run out before they can support the people that they want to support here? Just to kind of to put this in perspective, yeah, The Correspondent did meet its crowdfunding goal, but it was a close-run thing. In the last couple of days, people weren't sure whether it was going to do it. By contrast, if you look at entertainment crowdfunding, they regularly smash targets within the first couple of hours. Video game Shenmue 3, it earned $2 million within 8 hours. This is a sequel to a game that most people haven't played and that came out something ridiculous like 12, 18 years ago. And that smashed its target. So will there be enough people who are interested in being news members to kind of support as many organizations who would like to do membership?
I think it works There are some examples of where this has worked on a really kind of local level. So like a little bit of Stone in Staffordshire did this a few years ago to be able to get a full-time editor for 6 months. There's some good kind of really, really local examples of crowdfunding for roles, for specific stories to be covered. Texas Tribune has done a bunch of that. But in many cases, you're going to actually need a very large gene pool to tap into, like The Correspondent has, to be able to potentially make that work. You've got to have a kind of name and brand heritage. So Correspondent has a proven model from the Netherlands, Tortoise, because it has James Harding behind it, has somebody who is known and kind of recognized in this space. I think for me, what's interesting about this and that particular kind of crowdfunding slash membership hybrid is that I feel a sense of investment in terms of the types of stories that are being tackled, and that I actually have a voice that can perhaps not influence the editorial, but which certainly helps to inform it. I think there's a difference between the two. So you have that on the one hand, and then on the other, you have the kind of more altruistic model like The Guardian of saying, this is a good thing, and it's almost like a philanthropic donation. I think that there has been a lot of talk about kind of organizations going all in on memberships, but you have to ask, well, what's the incentive? What do people get out of this? And I think it's a mixture of sort of three things for me. One is the ability to kind of inform something I think is important, like the Correspondent model. There's the kind of altruistic element of The Guardian, or there's the kind of the third element, which you see at the likes of kind of Min Post in Minnesota and elsewhere, where if I become a member, then I get access to a whole range of other potential benefits, like a New York Times subscription thrown in, or get access to events, or I get access, like with Slate, if I'm a member of Slate Plus, I get all your podcasts ad-free, and I get the opportunity to, I get a discount off tickets for events and so forth. So there's an incentive to become a member. Membership for the sake of membership itself doesn't work.
I mean, there's two kind of quite separate membership offerings that have come out of this. There's the one which is you pay X amount a month or a year and you get all this extra stuff, bundling. I think we saw quite a bit of that over the last couple of years. But I think that the thing that's really interesting with the other side of it, which is whether you pay a pound, whether you pay £1,000, whether you pay £1,000,000, you are still a member, you are still a founding member. Yes, we might do perks and benefits based on how much you've paid. But that, I think, addresses this problem that we're seeing with a lot of people putting up paywalls, which is if I only read a couple of things on your site, but I still want to support you, I can pay you a couple of quid. And it's not, oh, okay, I've got to pay $9.99 a month to have access to all this stuff. It's that's what I can contribute if I'm not very well off, or you know, in I've got too many Spotify subscriptions, that's what I can afford to contribute to you. And I think that, in a sense, answers that problem of everybody's put up paywalls. Well, if you do a contributor model, it's a lot more accessible to people, I think.
That does rely on having affinity or recognizing there is value there. So I'm thinking of the number of people who
works
kicked
The Guardian
in.
Though, didn't it?
It does, yeah. But I was thinking the number of people who I've kicked in to support are individual creators, or who are, you know, doing a service that I think is valuable to the wider industry. There's a freelancer newsletter, a link to which I'll put in the newsletter this week, where they just, all she does is do 10 freelance opportunities and a picture of her dog, and it is a fantastic newsletter. It's a really good opportunity for people. But you know, you kick in the cost of a cup of coffee at the end, because you go, well, that has been genuinely useful, and I sort of get a sense of who the person is who is providing this.
And this comes back to one of the points we talked about at the start, which is about the price of entry and trying to remove some of those barriers, or looking at different ways to kind of innovate in that space, because it does feel that there's not a lot of innovation in terms of pricing. Where's the low income model for many of these things, or a low user tariff? I see this a lot with a lot of my students who have access to a whole bunch of things because they get a student subscription. Then the moment they graduate, that disappears, but they may graduate to unemployment or to a low paying job. Yeah. And it takes them it's going to be a period of time before they have enough spare cash to be able to resubscribe to these things. There needs to be more innovation in terms of pricing models. And the examples that Esther gave, I think, are one way that you can potentially navigate around that, by basing it on kind of like willingness and ability to pay, and still treating people with respect and making them feel like they have contributed to something valuable.
And I think there's that ties into to micropayments. I know there are a lot of micropayments vendors out there. They tweet me every single time I write about them. But it would be what I think one of my wishes for this year is it would be really nice to see a micropayment solution of some sort actually go mainstream and really crack it. Because I think it's just missing that seamlessness at the moment. And once that's married up, you know, look at some of the things WeChat's doing in China with you can almost tip for an article.
Mm.
If we can get some of that in Western Europe, that would be amazing in 2019.
You see some of the membership models make access to individual journalists kind of a key tenant of what they're offering. And for the last couple of months, I think there's been this groundswell of opinion that will actually help combat this kind of endemic fall in trust that we have in journalism if you can reach journalists directly as a result of paying for a membership model. In fact, the act of paying itself tends to engender trust in that news outlet. So do we think that there's going to be any solution to this widespread lack of trust in the, you know, quote-unquote mainstream media this year? Or do we think this is kind of just something that we're going to have to contend with for decades going forward?
I think one of the things it's very easy to forget when we're talking about trust is that there are different tiers of trust here.
Mm.
So mainstream media tends to throw in newspapers, television, platforms, local journalism. You know, it seems to be a sort of catch-all label.
Yeah.
But actually, there are different levels of trust in different organizations. So people tend to trust local journalists, local journalism outlets, much more than, say, national outlets. And I think partly a lot of that is about visibility. And I've written about this recently. I think there is something about visibility, be that physical or virtual, as you suggested there, Chris, with some of the membership models, that if I can have an interaction or I see you physically reporting from something, then I'm much more likely to trust you. I think that's important, that visibility is important and the organizations need to build in time, which is, I appreciate, really hard when everybody is time pressed, but actually that this needs to become a KPI. This has to be part of your performance and part of the way in which you are, the success in role is acknowledged is through interaction with audiences, helping to build communities. I think that's going to be increasingly important during the course of 2019, particularly as if we move away from scale being all and actually recognizing you need to essentially super serve your core audience, and that they're the ones who may well stump up for additional premium products. You need to reduce churn. It's incredibly expensive to bring in new subscribers and new users. So one of the ways in which you can address that is by engaging with the audience that you already have and doing so in a very kind of transparent manner.
There was also that great Reuters study that basically showed that people trust public news organizations a lot more than they do private ones, which I was kind of unsure how the methodology of that, because it implied that people have kind of an inherent knowledge of what is a public versus private organization, whereas in a lot of the cases it's kind of...
They have no idea. I can guarantee you, they have no idea. Look at the Ofcom media literacy research for the UK, and you'll see something like, which they've been doing for years, you'll see something like about a third of people have no idea how the BBC is funded, or like 20% of people say, I don't understand how commercial radio is paid for. Well, what? It's the fucking commercials you listen to.
It's in the title. What the hell?
Yeah.
Damien, thank you very much for coming on this very first episode of 2019. Hopefully there's some hopeful stuff in that episode as opposed to the doom and gloom that we normally talk about.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
So we're now able to offer transcripts of our interviews thanks to our partnership with Trint, who have a clever AI automated transcription tool for audio and video. Look out for more details both about them and for the transcripts in our weekly newsletter, or do get in touch with us if you'd like to be added to the exclusive email list to receive the transcripts as soon as they go live on a Monday.
So thank you so much for listening. To our super fans, especially who listen on Christmas Day at 8 in the morning, I mean, respect to you guys. And generally over the Christmas period, you know, hi to all our new listeners.
For those new listeners, we have a weekly newsletter, which you can sign up for on our website at voices.media. It contains links to everything we've spoken about that week, plus what we're reading, what we've written elsewhere, and much, much more, including a sort of mini article that we write about that particular episode. You can find us on social media at Media Voices Pod, or I'm at Chris M. Sutcliffe.
I'm at Esther Kaziah T.
and I'm at Damien Radcliffe.
Nice. Until next week, when we're going to be back with another fantastic guest. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.